Here's my suggested title, assigned, not quite, but suggested. I'm going to be talking about how we can use not the Lyman alpha force, but gamma ray observations to assess something about these plasma instabilities. It's, of course, a collaborative effort, but I would like to single out one person, Paul Tita, who started working this as an undergraduate. A lot of the pictures and the analysis I'm going to show you is directly due to him. All right, so not to belabor the point, I think we've all seen this story before, but the things that we agree on, importantly, are that some AGN jets emit beamed TEV emission, or baryon energy gamma ray emission, and those will produce pairs on the EBL. And where there may be, and there's certainly observational evidence for that, Marco showed some of these the other day, where we might be a little bit more controversial is what happens next. Certainly, a number of us have been arguing about for plasma instabilities. There's always the possibility that they don't operate. They saturate at low levels and are unimportant. If plasma instabilities are the dominant way in which the pair is cool, then we've talked about how that deposits energy in the IGM. If they don't, of course, the pairs inverse Compton cool and gyrate on a magnetic field. And we've heard a lot about that, not just from people listed here, but everyone else. And so I'm going to talk about how looking for the pair halos that you see from the inverse Compton cooling can help us assess the development of plasma instabilities. And I'm going to do that primarily in two ways. One, I'm going to look for indirect evidence that they're not there by looking at the statistics of the gamma ray sky. And then I'm going to spend most of my time talking about what I think is a novel way to go after detecting the gamma ray halos. Okay, so beginning, what if they don't exist? Hints from the gamma ray sky. Now something, people have mentioned this blazar luminosity function that we've suggested. And I did want to spend a moment explaining where that came from, the terrible assumptions we've made, and why maybe you should believe it nonetheless. I do note with some irony that we correct for things that we don't possibly know. That's true. We've made an assumption. I think this is probably justified by market theory, right? Nobody builds a telescope that has a sensitivity far above the current limits. So we're assuming that all the TEV observations out there have a similar flux limit. And we ignore all the biases in the sample, which are many. But if you do that, and you try to construct a luminosity function for the current population, a present-day luminosity function for TEV objects, you get these black dots. And those black dots are compared now to the luminosity function from quasars, but just shifted. Okay, so I thought that was remarkable, that it looked like the contemporaneous quasar luminosity function. If you told me I had to live with the orange line, we could probably shift that as well. But nevertheless, based on that, we asserted some relationship between the local luminosity function of the TEV bright objects and quasars, and this actually. Is a natural thing for somebody who studies accretion theory, because you imagine that these are just in different states. They're regulated ultimately by the same mechanism, which is availability of gas, and they really form contemporaneous parts of a single population of objects seen in a variety of guises. The natural assumption then is that they would be related in the past. Is this obviously true? Certainly not. A point was made the other day about beaming corrections, and I think that's a non-trivial thing that we've left out, but I'm not terribly sure that those are going to change this story. And the reason is that people have looked at the opening angles and viewing angles of the gamma ray bright AGN, gamma ray bright blazars, by comparing the objects that appear both in the Mojave radio VLBI data set and the Fermi data set. And based on that, I'm going to try to argue a little bit later the quantitative elements of this, but based on that, 1 over the Lorentz vector of the jet, so typical angular scale over which the flux changes, the Doppler factor changes appreciably, times the opening angle of the jet is of order 2. So we're always looking essentially down the jet. So I don't think that the beaming corrections, which will broaden this picture, okay, the beaming correction that just shifts our definition of energy, of luminosity doesn't matter for our purposes, but broadening and changing the shape of this, I don't think is terribly important. So now this gives us a, you know, we have a prediction for what the luminosity function looks like. We can start to validate that prediction. Of course, it depends upon not just how many objects we have, but also the shape of their intrinsic spectra. Okay, and so again, we can empirically calibrate the shape based upon the variability in the shape of the spectra of the Fermi objects, which we've done, and that seems to fit with the population of the kinds of objects we're looking for. But we have a zero-parameter model. We have a prediction for what the luminosity function looks like, and we can start to check that against data. And there's two ways we can do this. The first is looking at low redshift sources, or the low redshift tail of the luminosity function using the statistics of objects resolved in Fermi. And the second is looking at the moderate to high redshift portion of luminosity function by looking at the background. All of these are really just projections of the luminosity function. Okay, so both the redshift distribution and flux distribution of Fermi objects really just the projection of our luminosity distribution. One important thing after Marco's talk that I think we need to settle, and it is not actually totally obvious to me, is that we're talking about the luminosity function of the same objects. Okay, so when I talk about luminosity function of TEV blazars, I mean objects which are intrinsically TEV blazars, not objects that Fermi sees as hard objects necessarily. And so I think that there's a little bit of wiggle room there when we compare what we expect. But nevertheless, we have this intrinsic luminosity function prediction, two different projections. The difference between these two statistics is really the limits. What part of luminosity you integrate over, what part of redshift you integrate over. And there's the selection bias of Fermi imposed. All the blue dots in this picture are really the hard gamma ray bright blazars in Fermi. And you can see by the time you get to a redshift of 0.5, you start falling off the backside, the high luminosity side of the luminosity function. So these limits really do impart themselves on the resulting distribution. If you do that, we find fairly good consistency with both the 1FGL and 2FGL. So I think those should be 1 lakh and 2 lakh. Catalogs of 8 gamma ray bright AGN. But we also find, as Christoph pointed out, good consistency with the flux distribution of the hard objects. And as Marco pointed out, this second catalog of hard objects, I think we get that fairly well. We don't see a break just below the flux limit, so I don't know, we'll have to see if that's real. But at the moment, I would say that we do a fairly good job of reproducing the statistics of Fermi objects in the nearby universe. Okay? Now, armed with that, you might ask, how do we do at high redshift? Okay, and the natural thing to look for there would be the extragalactic gamma ray background. Here's a relatively early plot from Fermi's extragalactic gamma ray background. And this is where halos, this is where the gamma ray halos begin to impart themselves, because there is a lot of energy in this high energy emission. And if it's being absorbed and reprocessed into lower energy gamma rays by Compton upscattering the CMB, then we ought to see all of this energy from very high energies deposited down producing GEV bumps, if not in individual sources, at least on the sky as a whole. Okay? So I think that, you know, I don't quite understand the idea that there's only 10% of the observed background could be comprised of halos. I think that this really does force you to have very few high redshift blazars if you believe the halos are there. Of course, this is, again, just a projection of our luminosity function. So here's a picture that we put out 4 or 5 years ago now, my goodness, that kind of makes the point. And I wanted to show this plot, not because I want you to pay attention. I'll make the point with moving energy from high energies to low energies in a moment. But I wanted to make a different point. Okay, so this was the Fermi background at that time. And we weren't quite sure what to do with the spectral shape at lower energies. of our intrinsic spectrum, but we had absolutely no choice. There's an exponential fall off. Now, any model for the extragalactic gamma ray background that produces a majority of the flux at high redshift will show this feature. Okay, but it's important to note that many models don't. Many models had a great deal of emission at high energies coming from relatively nearby. And we made this absolute unmovable prediction that this had to be true, and this is what happened with the Fermi data. And we did not change a single parameter. Okay, so we actually got this spot on, making what I malign every day, a prediction for a sudden change just beyond the measurements, where the measurements are. Okay, so I think we went out on the line there, and it turned out to be right. I call that a prediction, and you can take it for what it's worth. Here is the intrinsic emission from all of the objects in our sample. This intrinsic emission, so if you really believe that the TV blazar has evolved like quasars, this intrinsic emission, if there's no efficient plasma instabilities, would have to be reprocessed down to between 1 and 100 GeV, down to about here. Okay, so this is why I'm worried, and this is showing energy, and that's what's conserved during this reprocessing. So this is why I don't quite understand this 10% number, because there's a lot more than 10% of the energy between 1 and 100 GeV in the background in this high energy emission that has to be reprocessed. Okay, so I think that fitting this absolutely requires that we do have no halos. And this really is a high redshift probe. Okay. So that means that as long as you don't have halos, then you can fit the high redshift.
So you keep bringing up 10%. So what is the 10%?
There was a statement earlier in the workshop that 10% of the 1 to 100, or the 10% of the Fermi extragalactic background would be contained in halos. Anyway, so if you want to believe, as I think naively I would, that the TeV blazars have to evolve very much like other AGN, then you need to eliminate the halos. Of course, as Martin pointed out, we could always just tweak the luminosity function. So that brings me to the second part. Let's try to find evidence for those halos directly. Okay. How do you find them? Well, the first thing is they're going to be big and they're going to be dim. Okay, so I think we heard yesterday someone malign the resolution of Fermi, but for this for these objects, Fermi's resolution is just fine. Okay, we're talking about many degree size objects on the sky. Of course, the dimness also means that they have a low surface brightness. This is the typical angular radius of a halo. There also has to be a reasonably strong intergalactic magnetic field if you think they're there. So not only are they big and dim, but they also have to be magnetized. And here's the classic argument from Narinov and Vovk, okay, showing that the absence of a GeV bump in a handful of sources along the line of sight implies that we need to have a magnetic field to gyrate particles out of the line of sight, again, taking the default position that these halos are really there. And that limit translates into a limit that's a function of the scale length in that magnetic field. Okay, so very, very large fields can be lower strength. Tangled fields have to be higher strength. Okay, and so here's the current, or here's I guess, the six-year-old plot now from Narinov and Vovk showing all the constraints on the magnetic field, and there's this big open swath. Okay, so much of the time we've been hearing about halos, people normally presume that they're large, diffuse, puffy things. But I'm going to try and convince you that that's, in most cases, not true. Okay, in fact, they look a lot more like bow ties. So we shouldn't be looking for halos, we should be looking for bow ties. And the argument I'm going to make in two different cases. Okay, in the first case, let us imagine that the magnetic fields are strong enough and tangled enough that the inverse Compton emission is nearly isotropic once the pairs are formed. Okay, and in that case, We have our AGN down at the bottom. It's emitting gamma rays, not isotropically, not everywhere, but only in this beamed cone, which is somewhat exaggerated, producing pairs. The pairs are going to cool on length scales that are very short in comparison to the size of the cone, so almost locally. And as they cool, producing these inverse Compton gamma rays all over the place, they're going to do so on the top jet and the bottom jet and all throughout. But we're only going to see the projected jet lit up. So we're going to see a bowtie. That's if we have a very small scale tangled field. Perhaps we have something that's pointed very much towards us. In that case, if we had very large scale fields, so nearly homogeneous fields, all the particles that were generated would necessarily gyrate on a cone, and in this case, where the magnetic field is orthogonal to the line of sight, in a plane. Okay, again, we have TV photons emitted in the cone, particles gyrating. In this case, the electrons gyrate one way, the positrons gyrate the other way, and we get gamma rays on the sky on either side of our source because we have electrons and positrons. And electrons, those pairs generated off of the plane, are gyrating a cone that never crosses the line of sight. Okay? So while they're happily emitting, they're emitting over there, not towards us. So once again, you end up with something that looks like a bow tie, except now it's not perfectly symmetric because the jet imposes the overall structure. Okay? But in both cases, we have some sort of bow tie-esque thing. And these two limiting examples really correspond to large swaths in the available phase space. Okay, this case where we have a uniform field really just means the correlation length of the field is very long in comparison to the size of the halos. And over here, in a nearly isotropic case, simply means that the correlation length is very small in comparison to the typical size of the halos. So there's a little window that these two models don't cover, and we're trying to close that. But at the moment, these two models cover large swaths. So what might that look like? I'm going to first begin by showing you a cartoon. I don't want anyone to get too exercised. It is just a cartoon. We're going to try to do proper physics later. Okay, and so here's a cartoon of what this sort of thing might look like. We have a background shown in red. We have a source shown in green. And 10% of the source photons are shown in blue. And if I didn't color code them, I would defy any of you to find the halo. Okay? Faced with dim features, the normal thing to do is stack. Were I to stack them, knowing that the magnetic field at each source need not be the same, I would completely wash out that structure, and I would get something that did look nearly symmetric. And this is just stacking 30 of them. And were I then to go look for an excess, like we heard Stefan talk this morning, surely there is an excess, and it is statistically significant if you knew exactly your PSF and your background. And if you don't know your PSF or your background, I think it would be difficult to argue, as people have had difficulty in the past, that there's any statistical difference between these. Okay, the systematic difference is small. On the other hand, there's another way. These halos have angular structure. So instead of essentially doing calculating a one-point function, just binning up a density, we could look at a two-point function, look at a correlation and angular structure. In that case, we effectively just compute an angular power spectrum. And when I say that, I don't mean it in the cosmology sense. I mean an angle around the center. Okay, so we measure an angle theta from some direction, arbitrary orientation, and we calculate the power spectrum of everything, every wedge. And if you do that, you get this red thing for a single source. The nice thing about that power spectrum is it is independent of the orientation of the halo, so I can stack that and maintain access to the structure. And if I do that for the same number of sources that I showed in the previous stacking example, I get the blue line. And there's very clearly structure on even multipoles, okay, quadrupole, L equals 4, et cetera, or M equals 4, et cetera, okay, only the even multipoles because of the bipolar structure. And that doesn't look like things like the PSF. And I will show that to you in a moment. So that's kind of a cartoon picture of how we're going to try and go find evidence for halos. We're going to look for it not in an overdensity, but in structure.
So why the distance that the T&D photons travel before producing pairs is like hundreds of megaparsecs, right? So why is it only a couple degrees? Or is this a really distant?
I'll show you.
It's pointed towards you.
Yeah, they're pointed towards you.
This one, right?
Well, all of the ones we're going to talk about. I'm going to show you actual calculations of halos and what a little bit of what goes into. But it's exactly it's two effects. One is distance, and the other is foreshortening.
I was going to ask some questions. Okay. How big?
This is a cartoon. Let's wait.
Is that the free parameter? Like how far away you're going to look from the?
Hold that thought. In 10 minutes, if I have not answered it, ask again. Okay, so the problem with this is Fermi, in all of its splendor, is unfortunately a one-time event, really. If we come up with a clever idea and run an analysis on the Fermi data set, we're going to have to wait another 10 years to verify it, and there's just no guarantee it's going to be there. Okay, so we want to make predictions, not postdictions. Okay, I want to know what we're looking for before we look for it, and we want to know what it means if we find it. And so that means we're going to spend a lot of time making quantitative predictions, in other words, building models, physical models of these halos, and trying to use those models to estimate what that power spectrum should look like and optimize the power spectrum that we look for. Okay? The physics that goes into that, first we need to know where the very high energy gamma rays are coming out. We give them a broken power law spectra, so a low energy power law, a high energy power law, broken at 1 TeV. If we move that down to 100 GeV, that might change things a little bit, and move it up to 10 TeV, it would change things a lot. We have an angular structure that we assume is a Gaussian jet. Okay, and I'll come back to the parameters of that Gaussian jet and whether or not that's a good assumption in a little bit. We have to be able to produce pairs. That part's actually fairly easy. We know what the optical depth looks like, and so it's just a matter of converting photon counts into pairs. We have to evolve the pairs, because the pairs, once they're injected, evolve both because they gyrate and because they inverse Compton scatter. So here we have the Boltzmann equation with the scattering term. But because the CMB is such a low energy, The emitted gamma rays, the IC upscattered gamma rays, are also low in energy compared to the pairs. We can make an approximation that the scattering kernel, which is really just a combination of the scattering cross-section and integrals over outcomes, is really just two delta functions. In other words, our pairs evolve by taking quantized steps down. The magnitude of those steps depend upon how energetic the pair was at that moment, and those quantized steps are relatively small. Okay, so we take something out of its current momentum and we deposit it in a momentum that's a little bit different. Okay, and when you do that, you can replace the integral over the scattering term is with a gradient, and all of a sudden, once we assume stationarity, we have a relatively straightforward PDE to solve. In fact, this is so straightforward that I can solve that analytically. Which I was very excited about when we had. Lastly, you need to take the evolved pair distributions and convert those into gamma rays. Again, that's relatively straightforward, and there's a few standard assumptions we make. Okay. Given that, now we need to know where to look. What energy range should we be looking for pairs? The first statement I would make is that the spectral index of the halo for reasonable high energy spectral indices is between 2 and 2.5, which means it's harder than the background, usually. And that means that you really want to push to the highest energies you can, because then your background is becoming as least important as it can be. Your signal-to-noise ratio is going up. You don't want to push down to low energies. So all the beautiful 100 MeV photons that Fermi Pass 8 has now provided us aren't helpful. The second thing is energetics. Okay, typical energy scale for 1 TeV, very energy gamma rays, pair producing, and inverse Compton scattering is about 1 GeV. Okay, if you go down much further than a TeV, of course, your universe is now optically thin, so your pair halo contribution is smaller. Another important consideration is detector efficiency. Below 1 GeV, 1,000 MeV, the effective area of Fermi is falling off. So once again, you run into efficiency problems. That extends all the way up now in pass 8 to a TEV, which is just magnificent. But of course, at a TEV, you're starting to absorb when you get any appreciable distance away. So we focused on the 1 to 100 GeV band. We thought that was a good middle ground between being energetic enough and not too energetic. So what do perihalos look like? Here's two pictures for those two cases. One where we have a very small correlation length, one where we have a very large correlation length. These are before the PSF being applied. These are after the PSF being applied. And you can see in the halo contribution, we have a very nice linear feature, nearly bipolar feature. Except this is a little bit of a cheat because we're looking at the jet sideways and none of the Fermi objects have the jet oriented sideways. Most of those have the jet oriented towards us, and then it looks sort of like that. If I were to fill this in, it would look sort of like the MasterCard symbol because it's just terribly foreshortened. Okay, and that's going to create difficulties for limiting this with the current sample set. But I think we're going to be able to do better in the future. Of course, the halo is not the only thing that Fermi will see. The other thing is the source and the background. So we've gone through and put in sources. Again, convolve the PSF backgrounds and halos to produce some sort of total image. Okay, and if you squint, I think you can still see the halo in this picture. Down when we have very tangled fields, very small scale fields, then it's of course very, very difficult. We can do this both for the back detector, the front detector, and the combined detector. So there's a little bit better signal to noise ratio. Right. And these are the images that we want to compute power spectrum of to decide if we can really distinguish them. So here are two examples. The power spectra of this nearly uniform field or large scale field. And you see the characteristic sawtooth design. The teeth aren't quite as deep as the cartoon. And the reason for that is simply the jet's more one-sided. It's not quite as symmetric. Down here, you hardly see anything at all. This is this extremely foreshortened case with the nearly isotropic emission or the small scale fields. Of course, were I to turn the jet sideways, I have there's the same number of photons in this picture as in the other one, but the jet's turned sideways. Again, I would challenge anyone to find the halo in there. It really is there. Here's the power. There's the evidence. Okay, so if we could find a population of objects that we thought were likely to be gamma ray emitters, like FR1s, that were tilted at large oblique angles to the line of sight, so not blazars, and go look for them in Fermi, we should see that. So we're going to do that. But for the Fermi objects, I think we're really constraining this. And now we need to start constructing a Fermi data set to compare against.
So how do you know that's not just noise? So.
What? This?
Yeah.
Ask me again. So we look at noise. I'll show you. So when we construct the Fermi sample, we do have to be a little bit careful because not only halos will provide structure in the angular power spectra. If you have a fringe that's too close, that will create structure. Right? If we have a background gradient, which happens when you get near the galactic plane, that will create structure. If you have a fringe that's far enough away, we can just zero in on the region close to the source. Ideally, we want isolated sources. And more than that, we want to know how far away they are. We need to know their redshift in order to figure out how large the halo should be. And we want there to be more than two halo photons because we're making a two-point function, so there's a flux cut. Okay, if it's too dim, the chances of having two halo photons is small. You're just adding noise, no signal in these angular correlations. Okay, so subject to that, here's our 20 gold star sources. They all are isolated enough, bright enough, and have redshifts. Okay. Now, just because we've done our best to remove obvious problems doesn't mean that we've removed all the bad apples. So what do the bad apples look like? Can I imagine having a contaminated source that's hard to see, or a gradient in the background, or maybe the entire background is made out of sources just below your detection threshold, so now there's correlations in the background. Or maybe we just have the wrong center that we're going to construct a power spectrum around. I'm going to show you in a minute. We can actually get the center very, very, very well, but hey, maybe we fail. Again, if I don't color code things, it's very difficult to see all except maybe the miscentered case. If you squint, I think you can see the friend over here, but maybe you'd also swear there's a friend there. The resulting power spectra do show low small-scale power. That's absolutely true. But it doesn't look like the sawtooth shape that you get from the bipolar jets. They're dominated almost always, I think in all cases here, by the dipolar power, the M equals 1 power, especially the miscentered case. Okay, and they show this smooth fall-off associated with this power in all multiples. So it doesn't look like our smoking gun sawtooth at low power. Doesn't look like that. Okay. Now to construct these, we do need a number of parameters. I had to characterize the source, its position, and what it looks like. Some of these parameters we get from our Fermi Gold Star sample by construction or for free. Okay, we know what the Fermi spectrum looks like. We know how bright it is. We know how far away it is. Some of these we don't care about, like the orientation on the sky of our jet is irrelevant by design. We've constructed our statistic to not care. The rest we have to determine or we have to model. So very quickly, determining sky location, we have a Gaussian, maximum likelihood Gaussian fitter that does this to 30 times better than the Fermi PSF, so far better than the miscentered example I showed you. The spectral shape at high energies, we just looked at the intrinsic or deabsorbed spectral indices of TEV sources that we had in our list that were also Fermi sources, and that gave us a mean around 2.5. Photon spectral index of 2.5 in some range, and so we just adopted this as a distribution and pulled trial values. Orientation, this brings us back to the Mojave Fermi sample with the intrinsic opening angles for the radio jet. Now that's the radio jet. We really need to know what's going on with the gamma ray jet, not the radio jet. It's not obvious that they should be the same. In fact, they aren't the same. And to relate them, we made an assumption that this radio jet opening angle set a scale. Okay, so that set an overall scale for the jet. The gamma ray scale might be proportional to that. And then when we look at a number of objects from different orientations, if the luminosity distribution is independent of the opening angle distribution, which is a big if, we should see an envelope of fluxes. Right, the very brightest sources will lie along the envelope, and all the dimmer sources will fill in the lower quadrant, but we won't have a lot of sources in the upper right-hand quadrant, okay? As we look off-axis. We found that's indeed the case. So this is viewing angle divided by this radio opening angle. This is fluence from Fermi, and we see this is the case. There's roughly a Gaussian envelope. For hard sources, for soft sources it's bigger, for hard sources it's smaller, and it relates this full width half max radio opening angle to the gamma ray opening angle modulo a factor of 1.6. Okay, so the jet opening angle is about 1.6 times the full width half max parsec scale radio opening angle. The other thing that we use to specify orientation, so that's the jet structure, is the assertion that we need to be looking at blazars, which means we need to be looking within 1 over gamma of the jet. Okay, there's well-known relation for these objects between their intrinsic radio opening angle and their jet Lorentz factor. Okay, so we pull isotropically from within that distribution. Magnetic field, where we need a magnetic field, we fix its magnitude and we choose a random direction. And I think we've made a mistake, actually, in that we chose its magnitude at each object to be a fixed value. But we probably should have redshifted our field, or blue-shifted our field. Okay, the field that's 10 to the minus 15 Gauss today should be something, 16 times 10 to the 15 Gauss at redshift 1. Okay, so we didn't do that. So some of the results I'm going to show you are probably pessimistic. And lastly, there's some level of stochasticity in this process, right? We are drawing samples of thousands of photons, and so we have to do that. And so the way in which we make quantitative predictions is we draw an unknown set of source parameters for our sample, our gold star sample, knowing what we know about it. We draw a set of gamma rays for a halo source in our background models to construct an image. From that image, we construct and stack the power spectra for every source in our sample. okay? And here's explicitly written down what the power spectrum looks like. And then importantly, we repeat. We do it thousands of times in order to generate confidence levels. So if we see a certain level of power, we know what that means. So here's an example of what that looks like. This gets to the noise question. This is what happens if we don't put any halo in at all. This is the null case. In the null case, everything lines up very nicely with the Poisson noise level. And here are the fluctuations, the 95% confidence levels. When I say 95%, I don't mean two sigma error bars. I mean the 95% confidence that you're below this triangle, and alternatively, 95% that you're above this triangle. Okay, so they're one-sided two sigma error bars. Okay, so the null case just looks like standard Poisson noise. That gives us an idea of how many fluctuations we expect to see. These are, in fact, uncorrelated. You can plot one against the other. They're all nice little Gaussian blobs. We could look at our small-scale field case, the one that looks very much like the MasterCard symbol. It's quite difficult to see. You do see a little bump at the m equals 2 multipole, but this is fairly consistent with nothing. So this is hard to tell from our gold star sample. Again, maybe edge-on sources. We're looking into them. This is what happens when we look at our large-scale fields. Our large-scale fields are very clearly inconsistent with the Poisson noise, okay, many sigma away at m equals 2. The sawtoothness is always there, despite what appears to be the large range. All of the multipoles are correlated with each other. The sawtooth moves up and down. So again, we can distinguish it from the bad actors. Okay. That depends, of course, on the magnetic field strength. This plot's kind of hard to look at, but this plot's just the inner 10 multipoles is a little bit easier. As we drive the magnetic field strength down, we approach the null case. So what does the data look like? So there it is. So this is the Fermi Gold Star sample. This isn't a little point to put the name on. This is actually the m equals 1 power. Okay, there's the m equals 2 power. There's the rest. It looks exactly like the null case. The distribution and the mean are spot on. So at least we can model a background and a source. This is what it looks like for all the other cases. For the small scale case, predictably, it was very difficult to distinguish, completely consistent with that. For very weak magnetic fields, also consistent. But by the time you get to 10 to the minus 16 Gauss or 10 to the minus 15 Gauss, very clearly inconsistent. We can reject those at 2 sigma or better. And that's a proper 2 sigma. It's not an astronomer's 2 sigma. I found it, and I'm not going to tell you how many trials I ran. Okay, we ran one trial. Okay. So what does that mean? That means on Neronov and Voss plot, we can completely rule out this section here, which you'll notice gets down to the limits that they placed. So if you don't worry about duty cycles and you don't worry about plasma instabilities, then there are no large-scale magnetic fields in the intergalactic medium. If you do worry about plasma instabilities, well, they're making a bunch of small-scale fields anyway, so it's still true that there are no large-scale magnetic fields. All right. So then let me throw up some conclusions. The first one is that these inverse Compton halos provide a natural way to probe plasma instabilities. Okay, so it's not just studying the extragalactic background light. It's not just a story about Lyman alpha observations, but we can also look in the gamma ray domain and say very interesting things. If halos are absent, we have a number of predictions, assuming that one AGN is as good as another. For the nearby, and more importantly, I think the background of the gamma ray sky. And those are proper predictions, and I think we did very well on those. And if halos are there, I hope I convinced you that there's another way to go look for them, using the beaming or gyration that results in this bipolar structure. And this is insensitive to known contaminants. It's insensitive to not knowing your PSF, insensitive to not really knowing your background, insensitive to other bad actors, other sources of structure in the image. And at the moment, the Fermi Gold Star sample, okay, the set that doesn't have obvious defects, is consistent with no halos at all. And that can be turned into a quantitative statement that we're seeking the best way to quantify, actually. But a quantitative statement that's at least 2 sigma or better, that there are no halos no intergalactic magnetic fields on scales much larger than 30 megaparsecs with strengths bigger than 10 to the minus 16 Gauss. And we're at present looking at FR1s edge-on to constrain the small scale fields. Thank you.
Thank you, Avery. Any questions?
So let's say we keep, stick with your hypothesis that the blazars trace quasars. Is there enough wiggle room with just the TEV spectrum that you could lower the amount of emission in the TEV and then have pair halos and fit the background? Or I guess I just don't have much sense for how much energy you can get rid of there.
You mean to fit the extragalactic gamma ray background, or
yes.
Do you mean to look for pair halos?
They're
sort of related, but
yeah, that's right. So the cascade emission at lower energies.
Yeah. Well, it's even worse. We ignore the cascade altogether. We worry about the first generation photons, and that's it. The cascade would be very important to bringing even higher energy TEV photons down. But the fact that we ignore the cascade means that we are looking at the impact only of 1 to 10 TeV photons. Okay, so if there's a cutoff at 10 TeV, that doesn't affect anything I said. I think people would be surprised if there was a cutoff right at 10 TeV. One thing that could change things would be where you put the break. We've put the break consistently at a TeV. I think we moved that around by factors of a few, and it didn't make a big difference. But if you move it by a factor of 10, okay, you have your Fermi spectrum's going up, your TeV spectrum's going down, and if I suddenly move this down by a factor of 10, obviously I have less flux up there. Maybe you can make things consistent. But I think the objects we're looking at, they still have rising spectrum in the 1 to 100 GeV band. We've looked at the softening of those. They do not turn over at 100 GeV. So I'm not sure if you can really do that. So I think modulo, you know, factors of a few change in the break. Cutoffs above 10 TeV. What you see is what you get. The big way to change it is to mess with the luminosity function. Of course, that doesn't change the halo, finding direct halos.
Any further questions?
So for the isotropic case, for the edge on FR1, you probably need a very strong field. Would there just a priority be some constraint on what the field would be in order to have a feedback isotropy?
So what you really need is full gyrations and small scales. So full gyrations isotropize you in azimuth about the field. And isotropy, tangled magnetic fields isotropize you. Okay. I think to get roughly azimuthal isotropy, you really want things around a few times 10 to the minus 15. So something around here. Okay. Everything in this blue region will be tangled enough. So now that means that your signal will increase until as we move up, it'll increase until about here, and then it'll be independent of field strength after that, a few times 10 to the minus 15. Of course, for very small scale fields, this limit's rising very rapidly. So I think if you're asking quantitatively, where's going to be the lower bar when we do this for the FR1s, we'll have to do it to tell you exactly. But I don't think a priori it's obvious that it's not going to be at the same level for a number of reasons, right? So how well you can do this also depends on how many places you look, how many samples you have. We have many more of those for FR1s, for radio observations. So that's a convoluted non-answer, sorry.
Well, let's thank Avery and Owen for wanting to speak to us again.